It's an honor to be here, by the way, and I appreciate John, who spent a lot of time talking with me about making this possible. This is my second time in this venue. I spoke here about 6 years ago for BYU alumni. So it's been a while since I've been here. Great to be back. I want to thank Nationwide for sponsoring me, by the way. I want to talk to you today about why smart people do dumb things. You ever wondered what's going on in somebody's mind where they do something so lame, so off the reservation, it winds up costing them everything? And you're scratching your head going, wow, why did they do that? Then you start thinking, would I do that? Well, I'm here today to tell you why these things happen, because I was given an opportunity to spend 4.5 years at the University of Crime studying this up close and personal. Now, there's campuses all over the country. It's very easy to get into, not so easy to get back out again. The tuition was pretty steep, cost me my country, my assets, my freedom, and my family. So I paid a pretty big price to talk about this. I'm very impassioned about this message. My sole goal in life now is to raise to a higher level of consciousness the fact that every decision that we make in our life carries a consequence. Would you all agree with that? Every decision we make, big or small, is going to carry a consequence. Would you also agree with me that sitting here today, we are the sum total of every choice we've ever made in our life? Every single one of them builds up to where we are. And I'm going to talk about decision-making, critical decision-making. Because when I went to prison, I was terrified. I thought, oh my God, a pretty boy like me, this can't be good. I went in there and I was scared. I thought everybody in there will be long, greasy hair, strung out on drugs, all tatted up, missing their teeth. And there's plenty of them in there, but there were a lot of people in there that looked like everybody in this room. And I thought, wow, why am I here? Why are you here? We all had this big disconnect on the fact that we were actually there. We couldn't believe it. We weren't the type of people that go in there. I mean, really, do I look like somebody that's been in there? And that's a rhetorical question. Don't answer that. So when I was in there, I saw this big disconnect to the point that the statistic that sticks to my mind the most was that 3 out of 4 of us upon release are going to do what? Go right back within 3 years. We continue to rearrest the same people over and over. I didn't want to be there the first time. I sure didn't want to come back. I started to reflect back on what my parents always taught me. 2 things. Number one, every door in your life that shuts, another door will open. Yeah, well, when you have steel doors slamming shut in your nose, forget that. The backup plan, every crisis in life disguises an opportunity. Well, I was in straight-up crisis mode. Where was the opportunity? And ironically enough, the opportunity was the fact I was with all these guys with one thing in common. They all broke the law. What a great think tank. And I started, there's nothing else to do in there. I started talking to them. I didn't have a master plan. I just wanted to try and glean what I could from them. And as I talked to them, 4,235 and a half interviews later, maximum, medium, minimum security, federal, state facilities, different states of incarceration, everything from wire fraud to serial killers. Is that a pretty diverse group? It didn't matter what they were in for. All of their thinking errors revolved around the same things. So this morning, I'm going to share with you what I maintain are the 8 critical thinking errors that underpin all unethical behavior. Now, as I unwind these 8 critical thinking errors, if your face flashes in your mind, don't be afraid. We all stick our toes in these waters. I just hit all 8 at once. Now, I'm going to talk about how I managed to do that. Now, why was I in there? I didn't need the money, the power, the prestige, the authority. These were my assets at the height of my earning career, valued in the millions. You're the right group to ask, is that a strong portfolio? Not too bad. Well, I maintained my diversification later. Let's see how prison smart you all are. I'm going to take a hand vote here of all 3 of these assets. You vote once to see if you know which asset is the most valuable to have in prison. Who thinks it's the radio? The tuna, the shoes. Ladies, you'll all be surprised to know that even in prison, it's all about the shoes. You got to be able to run. Now, why do we even talk about ethics? And by the way, I come to Salt Lake City and speak several times a year, and I know I'm preaching to the choir when I'm up here, but why do we talk about this? How fragile are our ethics? Well, we like to think they're rock solid. We'd never do anything where we would get ourselves in trouble. But how quickly can they dissipate? Would you agree with me that you've spent your entire career building your financial client base around your personal integrity? And that if you didn't have your personal integrity, you wouldn't be sitting here. So you're all successes because you carefully constructed yourself that way, and I admire that. But the question is, how quickly can it dissipate? We spend our whole life building our reputation, it can go right out the window. I'll give you two examples of how fragile it is. Number one, if we had a product today that we needed a world-renowned celebrity, rock solid, this kid was gold in the bank, who would we go get to endorse our product up to 2 years ago Thanksgiving? Tiger Woods. I mean, I live in Southern California. I watched every year that kid was on TV. For 30 years, his father crafted him. He was rock solid. And then all it took was a 9-iron and a fire hydrant. And the kid was done. He lost 80% of his sponsorship in 1 week. He just lost Nike, his last sponsor, about 3 weeks ago. When's the last time you saw him on a commercial? 2 years ago. Went like that. Where was all his support? Gone. Give you another example. What car do we all want in our driveway for the last 50 years because it never seemed to break? A Toyota. Now, if we were going to go buy a Toyota today, would we spend a little bit more time doing some due diligence? You better believe it. We're not just going to go out there, but it takes a knock in the head like that to really get it. I do client appreciation dinners all over the country. Now, when I'm at the banquet, it's usually an annual event, and a couple brokers will bring in their clients. I sit in the back at one of the tables and have dinner because I'm the dinner speaker. They don't know who I am. I say, let's go around the table. Let's talk about why we're all with this broker. And as people go around the table and they say, well, I'm with this broker because, how many of them do you think say, well, I'm with that broker because their product is 25 basis points cheaper than the next guy? Or their product's 1 year shorter in the withdrawal penalty? You know what they say? The number one thing they say every time? They trust you. They believe in you. They believe that you are going to look out for them. What's the number two thing they say? They can get a hold of you. Isn't that so basic? But they can reach you. That doesn't mean you answer the phone on the first ring, but by God, by within 24 hours, you're back to them. And if you don't know the answer, you say, I'll get right back to you. And within 24 more hours, you do. And if it's bad news, you get in front of it, you call them, you have alternative investments, you have ways and strategies, and you're looking out for them. It's that basic. You all know that. But it's very interesting at these dinners to know how quickly that can dissipate. Where do you think I grew up? I'm going to give you three votes. If you know the answer, don't vote. I live in San Diego, California. Who thinks I grew up out west? Midwest. Is Utah in the Midwest or the West? West. How about the East? Yeah, everybody votes for the East. You'd be correct. Eastern Iowa. I grew up in a small farm town, 2,000 people, knew everybody in town, strong Midwestern values and ethics, a child of the 50s and 60s. My parents, part of the World War II greatest generation. We did not have any money. We didn't have a television. Even if we did, there was no reception. I didn't care. I played sports, worked on the farm. My parents were always there for their four kids. They did not care what kind of house or car we had. They cared about those four kids, and that's what I grew up on. But when I got to be 17, everything changed for me because I was ready to go to college with two criteria. Number one, no snow. Number two, lots of fun. What state do you think I wound up in? Arizona State University. I was the guy clapping in the back when you said that. Some would say that was my first critical thinking error. I roll into Tempe, Arizona in 1972, the number one party school in America. 25,000 students, I didn't know anybody. I spoke there a couple weeks ago for the executive MBA program. The enrollment today is 107,000. I love saying that at Ohio State and Texas, believe me. That's double the biggest, next biggest school. But 25,000 was plenty. I was in over my head. I thought, what was I thinking? First week of school was bad for me. By Friday, I had packed my little bag. I was out the door. It was noon. A couple guys are walking by. They said, well, where are you going? I said, I'm going home. They said, well, why don't you come with us? Which today's not such a good idea. I said, where are you going? They said, we're going to a party. You know, it's noon. Then they dropped two bombs on me. Free beer and sorority girls. Well, I didn't know what a sorority was, but I knew what a girl was. I said, yeah, I'll go with you. We went to this thing called a fraternity house, a social fraternity. Solved my whole problem, instant family. I joined. Created a new problem almost immediately. I changed my major from finance to socialization. And I set out to have a good time, and I succeeded. First summer came around, 118 degrees in April. What do you tell everybody that is? Normal, yeah. It's a dry heat. You know what? Stick your head in the oven. Turn it up to 450. That's a dry heat, too. How's that working for you? I don't like heat. That's my crisis. My opportunity is all my fraternity brothers are going home for the summer. I'm going with them. I bounced around the country that summer and I saw a lot of things. What did I see? Big houses, nice cars, money for tuition, books, whatever you need, son, we got you covered. Don't we consciously or subconsciously compare how we're doing in life against our peer group? We want to make sure they don't have more things than we do. In fact, we love it when we have more things than they do. Well, I saw this stuff and I thought, this is my peer group. I should have all that. By the time I got back to school in the fall, I'd rewired my value system. The queen mother of all critical thinking errors was in play here, called entitlement. What does entitlement mean? The world owes me something in exchange for me doing what? Nothing. Why? Because I'm all that. Or I've earned the right to fill in the blanks. You got any clients with entitlement issues? Well, I'm entitled to a 25% guaranteed rate of return with no fees. Go see Bernie. He's waiting for you. You know, entitlement is, anybody have teenagers in here? Got any entitlement issues? Hey, Dad, give me some money. Why? Because I got to go. It's their world. We're just passing through. Entitlement, very dangerous creature. That was the number one thing I saw weaving through every one of those inmate stories. Can you think of any public officials that might exemplify this? Who's that guy? Elliot Spitzer, former love gov from the great state of New York. Now, Elliot Spitzer is an interesting guy. I speak on Wall Street a lot. I'm going there Sunday night. I'll be there next week. When I talk to the brokerage houses, we still talk about him. What do we talk about? Remember when he was attorney general, he was going to fix Wall Street? He thought it was the most scandalous place he'd ever seen in his life. And it was his God-given challenge. It was his challenge to go save us. Well, he barged into every one of those, as attorney general, every one of those brokerage houses unannounced with his 20-man posse, stomped around, I'm going to drive a stake through your heart. I'm going to ruin your life. Poisonous. And he was out the door. One of the things he did as attorney general is he discovered that people that worked for the state of New York were stealing money from the general fund. Well, you're not supposed to do that. So what did Elliot do? He created this elaborate auditing system to catch them, and it worked. Started picking people off, putting them in jail, saving the state money. He decided to run for governor. I spoke on the same platform with him at three universities across New York State while he was running. And what did he do? He extolled the virtues of this wonderful program he created that was saving the state all sorts of money. And nothing wrong with that, because it was working. Then he got elected. Then he became governor. Then he became customer number nine. How did he get caught? His own system. Did he forget the thing was there and that it worked? When you get into entitlement mode, you calibrate up here. You're a little better than everybody else. You all should comply with every law. Me, I don't hold myself that same way. I call them Teflon people because nothing sticks to them. We have a Teflon governor in my state, too. Everybody seems to have some official of some sort. Now, I'll get off Elliot's case here other than to share with you one thing. If you don't remember anything else I share this morning, remember this. If you're ever in a position where you're thinking about doing something where your mouth's going to look like that, just don't do it. Ethics 101. I got back to school in the fall. I was all excited. I was all pumped up. I was entitled. Who noticed this change in me was my mom. My mom from Des Moines, Iowa. She calls it like it is. I hope you have a mom like mine. She called me out on the carpet and said, what happened to you? I said, Mom, I'm in college. She said, no, you've changed. All you do now is talk about money. And I knew she was right, but in my mind I was thinking, she didn't get it. I'm part of the new baby boomer, cutting edge, take no prisoner, entrepreneurship school at Arizona State. We're taught to take no prisoners, hit the bottom line, the ends justify the means. We were the Gordon Geckos of the future. We were all destined to be millionaires. It was a race for the door to see who got there first. Anybody old enough to remember those heady days? Now, ASU wasn't teaching us that, but that's what my peer group thought. Major disconnect. I left school after 3 years. I didn't want to be there, couldn't afford it. It's hot. I wanted to live at the beach, moved to San Diego. Went into retail in the 70s. I didn't like retail, but toward the end of the 70s, there was this thing coming out of New York called financial planning. It was being motivated by this person. I'm going to take a trip down memory lane with y'all now. This person named Vanita Van Caspel. Who remembers her? Vanita Van Caspel wrote these books. She was the Susie Orman of her day. If Al Gore had invented the internet just a couple years earlier, it would be Susie Orman out, Vanita Van Caspel in. Vanita had started writing these books about how there was this profession that was going to gel, self-regulate, be one-stop shopping, all the things it is today. Well, in the 70s, financial planning basically was a high school football coach selling insurance at the kitchen table on weekends, and his sales were in direct proportion to his win-loss record. We had someone over here selling mutual funds. Nobody really had a beat on those. And somebody over here did taxes out of their garage part-time. Vanita, though, saw the vision. And I read those books, and I thought, I love helping people. I want to be part of that. I started firing off my half-page resume all over New York, because that's where all the action is. In 1980, I got a call from a Wall Street firm. They were young. They were dynamic. They had just been listed on the New York Stock Exchange. They had this new product that was going to beat inflation and beat taxation called limited partnerships. Anybody go back that far? They needed brokers. They asked me to fill out the Myers-Briggs personality profile. You ever filled that thing out? Here's what mine said. AAA personality, driven, compulsive, willing to do anything and everything to get ahead. Do you think Wall Street was looking for me? They called me right back. They said, we want you in New York for an interview. I'd never been to New York in my life. I thought, wow, this is pretty cool. I don't have money for a ticket. We'll mail you one. I got into my closet all excited. I had three suits, all polyester. One of them was leisure suit. Thank God I put that aside. Who's had a polyester suit in here? This is, John, this is my group. Thank you very much. I love this. I'll give you a little laundry tip I learned. If you run your polyester suit through the washing machine two times in a row, it's extra shiny. I shined mine up, I borrowed some shoes, borrowed a suitcase, I was off to the Big Apple to make my fortune. Landed in LaGuardia Airport, first time in my life, I'd never seen that many people in one room, found out something quick about myself. I have claustrophobia bad, which didn't serve me well later either. So I decided, I'm not going through those people. I went around the building, jumped in the taxi, said, Manhattan, please, and settled in for the 6-hour drive. It's right over the bridge. We got to the Chrysler building, nearly the top floor, beautiful offices, the wood smelled good, the girls were pretty, there's the park I'm in. Don't know what you do, don't care. They said, well, we need you to spend a day down on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Sure, whatever. Who's been down on the floor? What'd you think? Fast and furious. They put me in a room this big with no doors, no windows, and 3,500 screaming New Yorkers because there was no computers yet. I'm locked up. For 2 minutes, I can't breathe, I can't move. Now, I'm going to give you a bonus critical thinking error because I come from farm country. Do we live in a personal instant gratification society? We want everything, and we want it when. When do our kids want it? You ever had a conversation with a teenager where their thumbs weren't doing this? It's kind of difficult. Are you trying to hold their attention, and they're, sure, yeah, right. Are your kids like mine where if they drop the phone for more than 2 minutes, they have a seizure fit? Because, oh my God, they're going to miss something. They're wired up 100% to make instant decisions. We have a generation of entitlement issues coming up behind us that are instant decision makers. You ever made an instant decision in your life that didn't quite play out? Yeah. Well, this is what we're dealing with. This is why I spent so much time at the universities. I've spoken for 235 universities now, including BYU, Harvard, Stanford, MIT, Cornell, Wharton. I'm out there all the time. And when I'm working with these kids, it's quite fascinating to see what goes on in their mind, especially the MBAs. And you know what? They're mad at us. They're mad at our whole generation because we cook the economy, we mortgage their future, and they can't get a job, and it's our fault. This is what's coming out into the hiring pool. I get that. It's a tough argument. Well, my personal instant gratification was I came to get a job. And then I looked closer at those people out there. You might agree with me. And I thought, wow, they don't look too good. I used to say they're tore up from the floor up. They eat too much, they drink too much, they smoke too much, they drop dead at 35. I'll get out at 33. I had the plan. Second critical thinking error. Super optimism. I'm indestructible, I'm invulnerable, I'm capable of failure. Faster, smarter, stronger. I never knew one guy in prison that ever said, yeah, I knew I was going to get caught, but I did it anyway. You can put super optimism and entitlement together, and you can call it arrogance. Is that the right guy for that? Note the mouth. I went to HR, signed up, took my Series 6, my Series 22, my Series 63, went back to San Diego, started working the fixed annuity 403B market. Whoever worked that market? School teachers. I love working with school teachers, even now. Sat in the cafeteria, worked nights, weekends. We were selling fixed annuities with a current interest rate of 15 to 18%. I'm old, huh? Remember those days? 15 to 18, and we had a crummy little 5% floor on those things, and we laughed about that 5% every day. Well, nobody's laughing now. I get clients calling me all the time saying, thank God you put me in that thing, that 5%, I'm killing the market. You never know what's coming ahead. And if you want to know what's coming ahead, turn around and look backwards. Full speed ahead, 80-hour weeks, I would not fail. Made a lot of money, bought my first house. The first guy in my peer group to buy a house, the only one without a college degree, pretty heady stuff. Then I got married. Now I need a bigger house and a nicer car. Then we had a son. Now I need a bigger house and another car. And all of a sudden, I'm on this wheel, and I'm hanging on for dear life. Anybody on that wheel? And I'm hanging on, and it keeps going faster and faster. Well, I had a lot of time to reflect on this later. It was one moonlit night. I was looking through steel bars, honest to God, and it dawned on me. When I got on that wheel was when I started to discount the family values as the perception of wealth that my family taught me, and I started to create in my mind the definition of wealth being pie charts and money and items and material things. When you're chasing that carrot, do you ever catch it? And when is enough enough? Never. When you're on that path, there is no carrot. It's all in your mind, and you're never going to catch it. Well, I was on it. Started to climb the corporate ladder of success. Now, as you all climb your corporate ladder of success, I always tell students, make sure your ladder leans against the right building. Mine leaned against a dollar bill. We need you in Texas. And by the way, when I was in Texas in the mid-'80s, tell me if this scenario sounds familiar. We had a bunch of good old boys out there that owned savings and loans and credit unions. And they were borrowing money from each other at 300 to 400% of the appraised value of the property, 100% financing, non-qualifying loans. Why? Well, the real estate went up 20% a year. There's no danger there. What happened? Savings and loans fiasco is what it's called. Thank God we've never done that again. Full speed ahead. We moved to Texas, back to California. Then they wanted us in Oklahoma. Is there anybody here from Oklahoma? Now, here's the real ringer question. Is there anybody in here with the FBI? That dictates which way I go from here. Good. We get to Oklahoma, get a nice big house. My wife and son stay home. I go build a three-state region from scratch. Texas, Louisiana, Oklahoma. Nonstop production, 100-hour weeks, no computers yet, phones, personal production, hiring, training, three full-time jobs. 4 years, 100-hour weeks. We have another son, more houses. Doing great stuff. 4 years later, I got a call from New York. We need you in the home office, national sales manager. Wow. I couldn't wait to get home and tell my wife the good news. This was always my dream to live in New York. Now, my wife grew up in San Diego, California. That's where her family and friends live. Where do you suppose she wants to live? San Diego. And I'm about to introduce her to the concept. We're going the rest of the way across the country. And this is going to be the 10th move in 10 years. Is that a lot? They were all good moves, though. Just ask me. How's this going to go for me, guys? I'm not going to ask the ladies. I got home all excited. We hadn't even unpacked from the last move. She said, what happened? I said, amazing news. My dreams come true. We're moving to New York. And as always, I have to leave in the morning, but you and the boys, you can take your time. Worst presentation I ever made in my life. She looked at me very calmly, said, well, I understand and I appreciate everything you've done for us, and I know that's your dream, and I encourage you to follow your dream. If it takes you to New York, I understand. The boys and I will be in California. Let us know how it plays out. Who thinks I moved to New York without her? Who thinks I moved to San Diego with her? Thank you for the courtesy vote, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, my youngest son sitting right there where everybody goes. I moved to San Diego, thank the rest of you very little. I didn't want to lose my family. Now I'm in a quandary because instead of being the master of the universe, my goal in life, I'm unemployed, but I was a CFP, registered principal, highly trained in high net worth individuals. I started thinking, I'm going to rebuild my book around people that make a ton of money in a short period of time legally. Who would that be? My first employer in college at Arizona State was a guy named Reggie Jackson. And all these baseball players that come into our office all the time at ASU that would go on to the pros. I knew them. Perfect. Started working with players all over the country. Boy, do they have entitlement issues. But they're a lot of fun. So I'm putting out their fires. I came home as often as I could. My two little boys, Daddy, we love you. We miss you. I always had a player with me. Football or baseball, these huge guys would come in. I wanted my boys to know how important their daddy was. My little boys would look up, nice to meet you, whoever you are. He'd sign some balls and leave. My boys, what did they want to do with those balls? play catch with their daddy like I did when I was little. Me, I was emotionally unavailable for that because I had to get back to New York. I had to sign more contracts, pick up more clients so I could make more money, so I could buy them more things so they could be even happier. Money meant happiness. I'm on that wheel. And I'm not proud of that, but I recognize that I had this jealous mistress that lived in my head called financial planning. You need more offices. You need more brokers. Well, do you really? By 1989, I had offices all over the country. I had the American dream. Brokers everywhere. One of my offices in Oklahoma City, because that's where all the NFL players came out of. One of my best friends was the manager of that office. It's my Series 8. I had an OSJ. She called me up the summer of 89, said her best friend was running for state treasurer. How big is that job? That's big. And I knew her friend, she was in Congress. I said, that's a great pick. My friend went on to say, well, she was going to run the campaign and help her friend get elected. Well, just keep an eye on the office. She said, well, if her friend got elected, her friend was going to take my friend with her into office and appoint my friend to be in charge of investing all the money for the state. Is that a big job? I said, you don't have any experience doing that. She said, I know, but I'm going to read a couple books and get up on it. Is that who you want running Utah? Is that who you have? You know, I spoke in Arkansas a couple weeks ago for the FBI, and they said, we'd settle for someone that could read a book. I thought that was kind of cold. I said, what makes you think you should go into office? She said, isn't it true when someone's elected, it's family and friends program, everybody goes with them, entitlement. I said goodbye and God help the state of Oklahoma. She said, well, I want you to come with us. I'm not moving back there. You don't have to. You have an office here. You have a presence. I could send you business to invest on behalf of the state. Who in this room would not want to take a hard look at that? Is that not the next step in the corporate ladder, working for a whole state? All my hard work, everything, I was entitled to this. I'd earned the right. I said, absolutely, I'm interested. Then she dropped the other shoe and said, good, since you and I are the best of friends, we've worked together for years, I'm bringing you into something you'd never get on your own. Where are we going with this? She said, I'm going to expect you to give me back some of your commissions. Is there anybody in compliance in here? You're all out of compliance? Oh, thank you, sir. Can two Series 7 registered reps with the same broker-dealer share commissions, yes or no? Thank you. Yes, they can. So is there a problem? Is there any issues in this scenario? Conflict of interest, among others. My financial principle mind, the logical mind, illegal, immoral, unethical. Clear as a bell. My emotional mind, you ever had your emotions hijack your logic? And how'd that go? The first step in the slippery slope of unethical behavior, I learned, is not a giant leap over the edge. It's a series of compromises we make along the way, ever so subtle, and then we get used to it, then we do another one, and pretty soon we're down looking up going, how in the world did I get down here? We got there one decision at a time, often very subtle. Mine, I'm not even supposed to be having this conversation yet, I'm entertaining the thought. And she makes this absurd proposal to me, and I started thinking, well, that's wrong. But then I started thinking emotionally, well, they're not elected. They'll never get elected. Even if they do, Oklahoma doesn't have any money. Now, how do you know linguistically you're in entitlement mode? When your self-talk starts to shift. When you want something, how bad are you going to go get it? Not that bad. When you need something, are you going to get it? Absolutely. I needed this on my resume. Then I could go down to Texas. I was working in Austin at the University of Texas doing pension planning. And while I was down there, I got to be really good friends with this really nice lady named Ann Richards. She happened to be the governor. I knew if I could get this on my resume, I could go down to Ann and say, Ann, look, I'm working up there. She'd have said, don't even go over that river. I got billions down here you can help me with. This is how those little pieces start to click together in your head without any malicious intent. I said to my friend, well, get elected, we'll figure this out. What do we call that when we make a poor decision and then we justify it? Are we a nation of rationalizers? We're darn good at it, aren't we? You've probably rationalized 10 things in the last 30 minutes. How many of you drive the speed limit on the freeway? Why do we choose to break the state and federal law when we get behind the wheel? If I asked any one of you individually, what are you going to tell me? The most dangerous phrase in America right there. How old are we when we start using this? Two. How old are we when we quit using it? Dead. It stays with us. I'll share a statistic with you that blows my mind every time. You know what the national average is for cheating in high school? Excluding Utah, of course. 74.1%. You know what it is in college? 80%. These kids shaping their character, are they shaping their decision-making tools before they launch into their careers? Absolutely. And that's why I'm just absolutely focused on these kids, because they need our help. They need a heads up. They need all of you to come into these classrooms and tell your story. Come in and share how you didn't start in middle or upper management. You worked your tail off. You worked nights, weekends. You made cold calls. You took rejection. You were due diligent. You built your career around self-respect and integrity. They love to hear that, and they need to hear it, not just from me, but from all of you. Well, I was swimming in this. Everybody does it, and besides that, they're not elected, so I'm not really committed. I said, get elected, we'll figure it out. They got elected. I went back to Oklahoma January 1990 to see if they had two nickels to rub together. Guess how much oil money they had in 1990? $9 billion with a B dollars, the beach ball. Nine beach balls. Is that a lot? 20 years ago when $9 billion meant something. And I started looking at the portfolio. You'll love this part. According to Oklahoma statute, they could not invest in any speculative issues, which their interpretation of that meant only government bonds, because we know there's no speculation there. So I looked at their government bond portfolio, heavily weighted in high commission, low yielding instruments. Who's making the money there? The brokers. And I thought, wow, I can do a better job than that. I've never traded a bond in my life. I'll borrow one of her books and get up on it. The plan was simple. All plans are simple at the beginning. There were 10 independent brokerage houses. They were going to buy and sell in and out of the government bond market. My friend, the shot caller, on $9 billion, she'd take a portion of it, take three random bids from the 10 firms, pick the one that was in the best interest of the state, keep your commissions low, competitive bidding. All of us would get the same amount of business all year long, no favoritism. First trade with my firm, a $100 million bond trade. What was my commission on $100 million? Who thinks it was over $100,000? I would vote that. $1,553. That's pretty skinny. Anybody here ever traded for a municipality? No. You know why? You're not going to make any money. The commission rate, 0.25025%. Called my friend up. I'm out. She said, wait a minute. Let me tell you something. Where's my compliance guy? She said, let me tell you something. I'm in complete control of this capital. Sir, is that a disturbing statement? Remember Alexander Haig saying that once? How'd that go for him? I said, you're not even an elected official. She said, no. Now, sir, raise your hand at whatever point this smells bad. She said, I'm the first one in the door every day. I'm the last one out the door every night. I work weekends. I don't take vacations. Smelling? Smelled this last two. I'm the only one with a key to the office. I'm the only one with a passcode to the Bloomberg machine. You roll all that together, is she in complete control? There's three elements to every fraud. I work with the white-collar department of San Diego and Tucson police departments, and I just bring this with me. Are all three of these present? Do we have opportunity to commit fraud? Yes. Do we have rationalization? Her rationalization is she was in charge of $9 billion, and they had the audacity to pay her a paltry $50,000 a year salary. She needed to boost her income more in line with what she thought her station in life was. How many times have we heard that story? And the motivation, the third part, send me the business, maybe I'll give her some money. She said, I can only pick you one out of 10 trades, raise your commissions. According to the law, NASD guidelines, 5% maximum markup. We're 25 zeros to the right of the decimal. Is that a big gap? Pretty big. Who thinks I mark my next bid up to 5%? Who's scared of voting? I did not, because I am not a greedy guy. Don't get it wrong here. 4 3/4, good enough. I'm sending her a message. I'm out. I want to go to baseball. I don't even understand this business. She sent me back a message. I made $156,000. That'll get your attention. I was in shock. I thought, I'm not cashing the check. The logical mind, I'm running. On the other hand, these people just started 4 years in office. I know I can get them four more. That's an 8-year run. That's $100 million out the door. Would anyone in here think about compromising your ethics for $100 million? Let me put it a different way. Since we have compliance in here, we're all taught to stay inside the letter of the law, correct, sir? 5%, the letter of the law. If you stayed inside the letter of the law, but your ethics are out the window, but you're walking away with $100 million, would you think about it? I thought, I don't know what to do. A confused mind does nothing. I'm going to wait till the end of the week and make my decision. You ever waited till the end of the week and it never came? Because in essence, aren't we saying, I've made my decision, I just don't want to admit it? Before the end of the week, we did another trade at $250,000. I'm up $411,000 in 1 week. Is that a lot? Friday night, my head spinning, I thought, don't get caught up in this, don't get greedy, you never expected to make $400,000 a week. In fact, from now on, if it takes me every other week, I'm cool with that. Who called me that weekend? My friend. What does she want? Money. I'm not giving her money. She said, then you're out. Well, I had that $100 million. I had that locked in. My greed goggles screwed on tight. I owned it. I was entitled to it. It was going to change my life and all the generations to come. And all I got to do is give her money. She's a friend of mine. I've known her for years. I earned the money. All these great rationalizations. I asked every white-collar guy in prison, what was the tipping point in your mind when you look back? They always say the same thing. The first time they rationalize, just one time. I'm only going to do it once. I could stop any time. I'm in complete control. First time you do something, it's a fast ride down with no easy return. I gave her $9,995 to avoid reporting. 2 weeks I beat myself up. I felt horrible. 2 weeks later, we did another trade. I made $200,000. I thought, cut that new house going in. I really needed that money. Can I stop any time? And I gave her some more, and I felt bad, but I didn't feel as bad as the first time because the state of Oklahoma was starting to make millions on our trading. A lot of volatility. We were nailing the market. So I'm not going to worry too much about it. Full speed ahead, sliding down. What do you think my wife said when we had $1 million in our checking account? Think she noticed? She called me up crying. I said, honey, isn't that great? She said, I don't know what you're so chipper about. We're broke. We're not broke. She said, I'm standing at an ATM machine right now. It's all zeros. How many digits in an ATM machine? How many digits in $1 million? Print the ticket out. $1,000,36. 2 minutes went by. Finally, she got on the phone and said, are you selling drugs? I said, I don't sell drugs. She said, come home and tell me what you're doing. The longest 10-minute drive of my life, I bought 24 roses and a flip chart. No PowerPoint or I'd have had one. Set up the flip chart, got my magic marker out for 20 minutes. Charts and graphs and diagrams. I wanted her to know this is way too complicated for her to understand. 20 minutes later, she said, you can stop any time. I get it. You do? Yeah, it sounds illegal. A couple days later, I visited my mom and dad who live in Mesa, Arizona now. My mom said, where are you getting the money? I got the flip chart out. Mom let me go for 37 seconds. Then she said, you can stop. You're going to prison. You've lost your mind. What's the matter with you? My two sounding boards, open, honest, candid. They know me better than I know myself, and they're calling me on it. Guys, as a gender, when someone tries to pop our entitlement balloon, ladies, do we listen? No. We crawl in our man cave. We pout. We get angry. We surround ourselves with our friends because we're not going to own up to it. That's where I was. Split from my mentors. It's never going well when you do that. Full speed ahead. The average life of a financial fraud before detection is 23 months. By the 21st month, I was up $6.5 million. I'd given my friend $500,000 in cash, had a third-party intermediary. He had a couple hundred thousand. The state of Oklahoma up $100 million. Everybody's on this thing. Do we get into a herd mentality? Forget due diligence. We're all making money. We'll figure it out later. Every bubble starts that way. In the 21st month, I didn't want to go to Oklahoma anymore. I'm lazy. I'm making a ton of money. Everything's good. I sent my friend an ATM card with my name on it. How smart was that? She decided that she needed the maximum withdrawal every day from those machines. Here's a government contractor with a government official with a government contractor card making cash withdrawals. What's on top of those machines? A camera, and they're on. Is this going to go badly if there's an investigation? 2 months of pulling money, didn't care. Then in the 23rd month, she fired someone in her office with cause. That person didn't like getting fired, although they had a bad drug habit. they knew my friend was living well beyond her means now, what do you suppose that person did? Went to the FBI. Do you think they cared? They go to church on Sunday and pray for one of these. You've got a rogue stock trader. You like that church mansion, huh? We've got a rogue stock trader in California, the state of Oklahoma. Wall Street's up to their eyeballs in it. It's a career maker. 6 o'clock in the morning, my front door, 5 knocks. Who's that? Yeah, you ever get 5 knocks on your front door, it will always be the FBI. Here's the breakdown. You can put this on your door. 4 knocks will be your local police, 6 knocks state police, 7 knocks Jehovah Witnesses. Everybody's got a knock. I look through the peephole, 2 young people, a man and a woman, dark suits, trying to serve me a subpoena for a grand jury. The man, FBI, that's bad. The woman, 10 times scarier. Who's she with? IRS criminal fraud investigator. And I thought, why in the world are they on my doorstep? As much money as I pay in taxes, why aren't they out chasing bad people? I didn't open the door. They started going around town trying to link me to her financially. Well, what's my dangling participle here? The ATM card. I became a victim. You know anybody that's always a victim? They play the blame game. It's always somebody else's fault, yet they continue to swirl in drama and failure. Because until you take ownership, it's so easy to dump it on somebody else. A year and a half later, I met with my attorney. 1993, day before Thanksgiving, he said, "You're going to get arrested." I said, "I'll pay you $400 an hour for that." He said, "Okay, here's your options. One, give me $150,000 and we'll get you ready for trial. Or two, take the deal." "What deal?" He said, "Well, they're offering you 15 months in prison if you tell on everybody." Why do we do insane things in our life? Because we fear the alternative. It might be fear of failure. Whatever it is, we'll do anything to avoid it. My fear of prison was driving me. 15 months sounded like a life sentence. I said, "What happens to my 2 friends? He says, "They'll get 15 years, but I can get you 15 months. Then he said, "By the way, when your attorney tells you that, duck and cover." He said, "By the way, they're getting the same offer as we speak. The first one in the door gets the deal." Any pressure there? 15 months, 15 years. Who thinks I took the deal? I did not. Last critical thinking error, situational ethics. Do we think in situational terms? Maybe instead of looking through the same ethical goggles at every situation, we look at the situation and then decide which set of ethics is going to cost me the least amount of time and effort and money. All of us speed on the freeway. How many of us will speed through a school zone with kids present? Nobody. So aren't we situationally saying we're 100% behind one law and 100% not behind the other? Are we thinking in boxes? You bet. Do we take that logic elsewhere? You bet. I was a very up and honest guy. I can't believe I was in this spot. I wasn't going to tell on anybody. I never had. I didn't trust the other 2 people. I was having a bad day. Got home, listened to my answering machine. Thank God you're all old enough to know what an answering machine is. Somebody left me a message I never wanted to hear from. Who would that be? Worse than all of them. "This is Ted Koppel with Nightline." Is that bad? How about that? Am I having a bad day or what? "We're going to do a story on you this week." Well, I'm thinking tomorrow's Thanksgiving, the next day's Friday. I didn't know Teddy's from Canada. A, their Thanksgiving was in October. He had no emotional attachment to this. So I just kept my mouth shut. Friday night came. The story was on. Sent my wife to bed early. Didn't want her to see it. We're hitting them all now. So I watched the story. Thought, thank God I'm the only guy watching TV. Next day, everybody calls my wife. She corners me in the house. "I understand you were on national TV." I said, "Honey, you know I heard that too." "Did you do this or not?" The same question I asked every inmate coming in the door, because they always said the same 2 words I told her that day. "Yeah, but." Called us the buttheads. "Yeah, but can you say that at BYU? Is that..." I said, "Honey, they're trying to put me away for years. You don't want that." She said, "I don't want that." I said, "Well, here's the options." I gave her the 2 options. I said, "We need to pick option 3, which is what? We need to leave the country, and we need to leave quick before I'm indicted." How do you pick a country based on that scenario? No extradition. Here's the list. Pick one for me. North Korea, Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Cuba, Libya, or Wyoming? That's not a good list with 2 little kids. So we looked at Europe, too cold. Africa, too hot. I need a place to park it where I can just get away and figure this out. Costa Rica. Who's been there? Isn't that a great country? The rest of you should go. I did. Quiet little democracy, Central America. I'm the target of an FBI investigation. Do you suppose they're watching me? And I'm getting ready to take my family and leave. The boys, 8 and 10, going to school every day. We manically pack. They come home at night. We hide it because they can't know we're bailing. One day they go to school. We ship it. We go to school that afternoon. Come on, kids, get in the car. We're going on vacation. Drove 40 miles south across the Mexican border to Tijuana. Took the midnight flight to Mexico City. We're out. The next day, my boys woke up in a country they never heard of, a language they didn't speak, in a school where they knew no one. Who pays the price for our unethical behavior? All of our loved ones, my parents, her parents, nobody knows. We just disappeared. How long do you think it was before the FBI discovered their targets missing and his house is for sale? What's the over-under here? 7 months later, I'm feeling pretty good. They must have forgot about it. It wasn't a big deal. Didn't have a lot of money. I couldn't drain my accounts, but you didn't need a lot back then to live there. I'm watching CNN. My face goes up. 32 federal indictments. Money laundering, conspiracy, bribery. Two people arrested in Oklahoma. My friends. They choose to go to trial. I'm not coming back. The only reason I'm here is John picked me up at the airport. He's going to run me back out in a minute. I wish you could see the look on his face. Sorry, John, couldn't help. They go to trial. They play the victim card. They're from Oklahoma. The jury's from Oklahoma. I'm not. They blame me for everything. How'd they do? Who thinks they did pretty good? Guilty on every charge plus perjury. They took a bad situation and made it worse. And I thought, wow, they should have had a backup plan. 2 weeks later, Costa Rica, I'm the only guy home. Five knocks, not the FBI, it was Interpol. You ever heard of Interpol? Their job's to snatch you out of a country, dead or alive. Less paperwork, dead, your call. Simple, here they come, guns drawn. My fear of prison greater than my fear of death. I ran out the back door, said, kill me now, I win. Some people say Ken Lay went out that door, I get that. And I braced for the bullets. They hadn't come all the way around the side yet. You'd be surprised how fast you can run when people are shooting at you. Like an antelope. Into the jungle. Now I'm in the jungle, an international fugitive, no cash, don't speak Spanish. They've got the helicopter, the dogs, the community surrounded. How long am I going to be loose? I'd say 12 minutes would be optimistic. 4 years. Central America, South America, Cuba, constantly in motion, constantly couldn't trust anybody, couldn't relax. How long did my wife stay when this happened? 3 years. 3 years she endured that. She believed in my innocence. The kids were happy. They didn't understand the turmoil. 3 years later, she said, this is insane. You're going to get killed. I'm out. I'm going back to California to start a new life. Jennifer, could you believe she was leaving me? After everything I'd done for her. How strong was she? She was so strong, she was showing me the right thing to do, and I admire her for that. She sold what we had, bought tickets. I watched her and the boys go to the airport. Without me, that's when I got it. Clear as a bell. You have to get stripped down to nothing to figure this out. And I was. The right thing to do is turn myself in. I called the U.S. Embassy, said, I'm coming in. They said, well, great. They were embarrassed for 4 years with me. They wanted me out. I said, I don't want to go to prison in this country. Oh, don't worry. We do this every day. We'll put you on a plane to Miami. You'll be arrested there. So I turned myself into the U.S. Embassy. They had me arrested and put me in prison in Costa Rica. You ever been in a third world prison? Whatever you read, it's worse. They put me in a room as big as this stage with 150 guys, a dirt floor, a pipe in the corner for a toilet. No electricity. They're all violent. I'm the North American. I'm the prize. I looked in there and thought, well, this is it. I'm not going to make it. And then I thought, I feel great. I was so ecstatic because I was doing the right thing, and it overpowered every fear I had. I went over and stood in the corner for 1 month. Murder mayhem. A month later, two marshals came to get me. On my way out the door, I asked one of the inmates, why didn't you guys try to kill me? You didn't have a problem carving anybody else up. He said, Senor, we're terrified of you. I said, yeah, I'm a big guy. I wouldn't mess with me either. He laughed and said, there's 150 of us. You were the prize. We'd use straws. but you just stood over in the corner like you were at peace with the world. There was no fear on you. He said, in our culture, we don't mess with crazy people. It's bad luck. Who's looking out for me? I get it. Off to Oklahoma, not my favorite picture. There's my perp walk. Hopefully you never have one of these in your living room. Walking into Oklahoma County Jail, 1997, looking across the street, what am I looking at? Someone blew up the federal building. And I can't, there's no words to describe it. Horrible. And I walked in thinking, what am I getting into? You get the idea. That's not my favorite picture. They put me up on the 12th floor of county jail. I thought, I'm in and I'm out. I took responsibility. They left me there 7 months. Timothy McVeigh, Terry Nichol, and their co-conspirators are all up there. 49 murderers and one white-collar guy. Murder mayhem. 7 months later, I went to sentencing. I'm standing there. I did the right thing. The judge will have mercy. He banged his gavel, said, Mr. Cousy, I want to give you 20 years. And then he said, I can't because you did the right thing. You turned yourself in. You didn't go to trial. He said, my hands are tied on giving you what I want. He started yapping for 10 minutes till number two went through my mind. I thought, before he's done talking, they're going to let me go. And they're going to give me back all the millions they seized. Is that super optimism? 6 years, 4 million restitution, 208 hours community service, banned for life from securities, 3.5 years probation, everything he could give me. Got on Con Air, went out to Death Valley. Got into prison there. My wife and kids came to see me 3 times in 6 months. The most depressing place on earth, prison visiting. All these little kids want their daddy to go home with them. And when he can't, they go home and face the harshest peer group in America. Their friends, God forbid, their friends find out their daddy's in prison. It's not the inmate that does the time. It's the loved ones. It's not you that will suffer the consequences of poor decision. It's your loved ones. 3 visits. I said, guys, don't come back. I can't see. I can't have it. You can't see this. They were so depressed. They went home, and all they could do is tell all their friends their daddy was dead. And this is what I attracted to myself because my vision of wealth had become money. And now look who's paying the price. Well, I decided I was going to do something positive and finish my college degree. It had never been done. They told me it was impossible. I love that word. Wrote to 100 schools. Western Illinois University wrote back. Get a guard to give you the test. Send us the money. We'll send you the books. My parents helped me with tuition for 2 years. I went to college. During that 2 years, I was the first guy to ever do that. By the time I graduated in 2000, there was 99 more guys with me. Started this whole chain reaction. We had 3 study groups of 30-some people. These were all repeat drug offenders. Yet I watched this amazing transformation in their eyes when they realized I don't have to go back and do this again. There's a better way of life. And we created this network, and we all started to think positively and work with each other and study and take classes. It was an amazing transformation. All 100 of us are out. We've lost 2 to suicide. We've got 98 left. Statistics say 80 will have gone back by now. How many as of last night do you think have gone back? 0. Not one guy ever went back. Isn't that amazing? Yet the statistics show that 80 would have. And you know why? It isn't that they graduated from college. Most of them didn't. But the circle, the influence, the power of the energy of the positive thought and doing better and not continuing to wallow, amazing. They wouldn't let me get my college degree in prison. They sent it to my parents in Arizona. I called them, collect every weekend because I was checking on my dad. My dad had a weak heart, and probably because of me, I get that. I wanted to make sure he was okay. That weekend, I called. My mom was crying. Mom, is dad okay? She said, son, your degree came in the mail. I can't believe you did that. She said, you're the first one in our family that's ever graduated from college under amazing conditions. Your daddy, a World War II vet, has never cried in his life. He's crying like a baby. I've never seen anything like it. He put the degree up over the fireplace. We're all fallible human beings. We all make mistakes. What are we going to do about it? Are we going to wallow in self-pity and blame everybody else and continue the same pattern? Or are we going to step forward, take ownership, and do better tomorrow? That's what I learned in prison. Released in 01, no place to go. They said, we're sending you to Arizona. Why? Because your parents live there. Well, they're not going to be too nuts about me coming back. They said, there's a halfway house at the airport. You're going there. Gave me a $20 bill, a used pair of clothes, a one-way ticket. And as they told everybody on my way out the door, they said, see you next week. The system is built for failure. I got off the plane in Phoenix, absolutely lost. Walked down the ramp, two people waiting for me, two people from the greatest generation, my mom and my dad with unconditional love. Amazing. They took me to the halfway house. They accepted me in their home for home confinement. I had 3.5 years ahead of me. Slept on the floor, drove a truck for $8 an hour at the airport, and I started giving talks wherever two or more were gathered. They could sign the form. I was your guy. Don't know what I said, but I gave 208 talks, and during that time, I realized this is what I was meant to do. Everything in my life had built up to this. When my passion was money, look what happened. Now my passion is exactly what I'm doing with you today. You can't put a price tag on that. Amazing. My boys came over from San Diego. They said, Dad, we love you. We miss you. They were in high school. They said, we don't trust you. They still won't let me be banker in Monopoly. Shrewd little devils that they are. They said, Mom's over here in San Diego struggling. You're over here struggling. Why can't we be a family again? Out of the mouths of babes, my boys are cracking the door this much. It was the greatest thing I ever heard. I called their mom. We got a house in San Diego, checked our issues at the door. I got to be a dad. The greatest years of my life were being their dad in high school. And I was a hands-on dad, and I paid attention. And when they came in to talk to me, I shut everything off, and I made them shut everything off. And I looked at them eyeball to eyeball. I didn't pass judgment. I tried to guide them and shape them. They went from C's and D's to straight A's. I take no credit for that, other than I was their dad, and I was never going to underappreciate this opportunity again. Never take that for granted. Those boys went on. They graduated. I cried like a baby. Here's this big, tough ex-con crying like a baby. Both graduations are in the Honor Society line. I thought, there's no amount of money on earth you could write a check to me for that would replace this experience. They went on to be outstanding young men. Fortunately, they're good looking like their mama. The fairy tale ending would be my ex-wife and I stayed together. We did not. We knew it was our time to go when the kids were gone. She went on and rebuilt this career in San Diego, continues to inspire me. She married this guy. He's so great I'd have married him if she didn't. One of those guys. Now I'm not even like that, and there's nothing wrong with being like that. Me, I went on and pursued my passion, which I've now spoken in all South America, Central America, Europe, 225 universities. This is what I do. This is what floats my boat. I get excited every time I get a chance to share this message with all of you. Not because I'm talking about ethics. I'm talking about real life. And I'm going to summarize everything I learned in one sentence for you. Income is never the definition of us. I made it the definition of me. I measured myself against everybody else based on income and material items. And look what happened. Look at the crazy story I got from it. That's not it. At the end of each day and at the end of our lives, the only two things that we have to take with us are our choices and our relationships. If we weigh every decision in our life right here in our treasure chest against our choices and our relationships, we'll lead the wealthiest life of anyone on this planet ever without coming in contact with our pocketbook. And I thank you all so much for listening to me. Thank you. Thank you all.